This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 18th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 75th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. I heard a thing on the radio last week talking about a new pope saying that 75 was the new 35. So this has no age limit, and if, like me, you're 35 but feel 75, have a word with yourself. Cut out the pies. Take a sabbatical and sit back, relax, and enjoy this show, which today has a mostly musical theme. More by accident than design, but, dear listeners, what happy accident brings these things together. I'll be chatting to the majestic Brett Anderson, lead singer of one of my favourite bands, Suede. Their new record comes out today.
Suede have always sort of lived and died by the quality of their songs. It's like kind of a healthy body wears clothes well. If the songwriting is solid, then everything looks good, you know.
We'll also be putting in a call to Alan Smolinski, a Californian entrepreneur and print obsessive who's poo-pooed the naysayers to buy his beloved local paper in Pacific Palisades. It's a heartwarmer.
And I just love feeling the paper in my hand. I love going in the driveway and grabbing all the different papers.
We'll also head to Mali to learn how the battle for hearts and minds of this recently war-torn country is being waged on the airwaves of state TV and radio.
We have the power because we have the radio and television, which are the real vectors for getting information to the people.
And we'll head to Suffolk on England's east coast to explore the magpie musical mind of a one-off sonic pioneer, William Adamson. Plus, we'll grab a preview of next week's Art Dubai, the Middle East's hottest ticket. Whoa, so there it all is then. That's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Ready? Then we'll begin. First things first, of course, a brand new track from the brand new album from Suede, one of the key bands in what was called Britpop, the UK's indie-tastic bid for musical and cultural domination in the 1990s. Suede were the gender-bending, interesting ones, the beautiful ones. We'll hear from frontman Brett Anderson in just a tick, but first, from that new album, Bloodsports, is Hit Me. Come on! Brett, thank you very much for joining us on The Culture Show.
Well, thanks for having me.
And the new record is a properly muscular incendiary thing, at least the first half of it is. It gets a little more ballady at the end. How do you get into the vibe? How do you G yourself up? I wonder what the sort of genesis of the record was when you decided to make a new Suede record, for example, rather than a solo one.
Well, it's very different, really. It's because it's made with Suede, there's automatically a different chemistry there. Mm. People sort of assume that, kind of like, I'm sort of sitting at home writing songs and kind of decide one of them's a Suede song and one of them's a solo song. It's not really like that. This album was very much made with Suede, and so there's automatically a different kind of feel to it. You know, I did the majority of the writing with Richard and Neil, and they bring their own identity to it, which I sort of respond to, and it kind of works like that. But as for how did we come up with the record, well, it was a very long record to make, a very, very kind of like complicated record to make, because I think when you're making music after a long, long break, you've got to be really sure not to kid yourself, that you've got to make sure that the chemistry is still there. And sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it needs sort of resuscitating, and sometimes you've got to work at it. And we spent quite a lot of time working at it and trying to get it right, yeah.
Because I guess 11 years since the last record, it was waiting for a few things to slot into place and for it to feel right, I guess. I suppose in the studio, when you're writing and then playing those songs you've written and laying them down to record the album, that it's all about the atmosphere and the vibe, right?
It is, but it's also all about, it's more about the songs, to be honest. Suede have always sort of lived and died by the quality of their songs. If you look at all of our great records, they've all been crammed full of really good songs, and records that haven't worked so well have been, the songwriting hasn't been as good. So it was always about that. You know, we spent a lot of time writing together and making sure we had the songs. I always find that's the hardest part. You know, actually recording stuff in the studio is simple in a way. Of course, you've got to be inspired and you've got to come up with things, you know, but once you've got the backbone there, which is the songwriting, And, you know, it's like kind of a healthy body wears clothes well, you know. If the songwriting is solid, then everything looks good, you know. It's kind of all the lines all run and everything, and it all works. And it's all about songwriting, really.
And it is a classic Suede record in that it's 10 songs. It comes in just short of 40 minutes. It's a great spare message, you know. It doesn't feel like it's been 11 years in the coming.
No, I really hate overlong albums, actually. I've got to be honest. It's a sort of pet hate of mine. I think there's a natural length to the human being's attention span when it comes to listening to a body of music. And I think that's about sort of a maximum of 45 minutes. So I really like short albums that kind of just sort of say their thing and then go away.
And the sequencing of the album is quite interesting. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. It starts very strongly, and then after Hit Me, which is fantastic, it chills out a little bit, doesn't it? Is that a thing that you do with the producer, the sequencing? How important is that?
No, that was very much kind of done post-recording and very much to do with really what I wanted, how I wanted the narrative of the record to work, really. I mean, the record is supposed to be almost like about a relationship from the start to the end kind of thing. And I wanted it to start off exuberant and kind of overexcited and have this sense of infatuation about it, and then kind of go through these sort of murky points that reflected different sort of feelings like suspicion and obsession and all of these darker things, and then come out the other end almost. And then the last song, Fault Lines, is almost like a sort of the calm after the storm kind of thing. So yeah, it's very intentional the way it's sequenced. Although we live in the wreckage and on the fault line, and everything we own, not everything we are, with every word we bring, we'll live. And in terms of touring it, how does that work? Obviously, you're taking the record out at the end of this month, kicking off the tour. How does that work when you've put the songs together in that sequence, and this album tells a story, as you say, of a relationship, when you have to mix them up with some of your earlier tracks? Is that a cool thing? Does that make you sort of realise the new songs, or is it a bit of a bind when you kind of want to tell the story? I don't think you have to. I don't think you worry about it. I mean, unless you're going to go and play the album in its entirety, do a piece like that, which we've done before with other albums, then you play it in sequence. Otherwise, you just sort of like take the songs that work in a live context. I mean, I doubt if we're going to play some of the slower songs that much. You know, they certainly won't be played at festivals and things like that. They'll probably get a couple of outings. So I think, you know, the body of the album, there's sort of six really solid songs on the album, and we'll probably play those a lot live, and they're the sort of things that will be able to work against Trash or Animal Nitrate or whatever we're playing at the time, sort of thing.
And how does it work in terms of listening to music? Do you have to cut yourself off from everything else while you're recording an album so you don't pick up any influences? I mean, I guess Suede's sound is so strong, your vocals are so recognisable, but do you have to kind of go on a bit of a music fast?
Not really. These days I actually listen to quite a lot of new music because I find it very inspiring, and I think that it's almost like part of the process, isn't it? It's like you need to take stuff in to kind of give stuff out. You need to breathe in and then breathe out almost. Yeah, I've never been worried about ripping other people off because, like you say, our style is quite recognisable and we're kind of just us. And I think we're very careful, very aware of that. If we ever sort of start kind of, oh, we don't really sound like ourselves, That's one of the things about this record. We wanted to definitely sound like ourselves. You know, we didn't want to be trying to sound like the latest hip band or whatever. That would just be absolutely pointless.
There's no banjos in this record then, and you haven't grown a beard.
No, unfortunately. Maybe for the next one.
It's going to be a hoedown. I can't wait for the Suede Hoedown album. It's.
it'll be so us, won't it?
It will be. I mean, it's all. Exactly, it's all of a piece with the back catalogue. And I wanted to maybe finish where we started by just kind of asking you about the feeling you get in your bones when you have that. I hear you have the itch to make a new Suede record. I expect people would like to know kind of what that feels like, Brett.
Well, I always have the itch to create new music. I mean, that's how I kind of define myself. And if I can't do it, or I don't, I won't. If I don't do it, then I sort of almost feel. I don't have a great sense of self-esteem. So, yeah, you're only as good as your last record, really, as far as I'm concerned.
And that was Brett Anderson, and the new Suede album, Blood Sports, is out now. We'll hear one more track from that at the end of the show. This is Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're crossing to the west coast of the US now to talk media and meet one man whose passion for print is so strong that he decided to buy his local paper. Alan Smolinski is a real estate entrepreneur from the western suburbs of LA who, after making his fortune, developed a deep affinity for the newspapers and the printed word. So when he saw his beloved paper, the Palisadian Post, was, like many local titles, going through hard times, he decided to help out. After a couple of years of negotiations, Alan took over as owner at the end of last year and is hoping to turn things around for the weekly. Not only that, Alan's the kind of man that subscribes to five dailies just because he loves the feel and the smell of the news in paper form so damn much. I caught up with him while he was on vacation in Palm Springs.
The Palisadian Post is actually an 86-year-old newspaper. It's a weekly. They've never missed a Thursday in 86 years. So through the Great Depression, wars, fires, earthquakes, floods, they've never missed an issue. And so it's a wonderful paper. You know, like most papers, it was losing money, and it had an out-of-town ownership about 2,000 miles away, and they had owned it for about 30 years. And eventually, the money-losing ways got to them, and it was about a two-year courtship. They wanted to make sure that I would be the proper steward for the paper, because it's really an institution in the town. And then the deal ended up closing in December.
So it's a two-year courtship. I mean, people might be surprised in days when there are so many headlines about newspapers. It's heartening to think that they had to kind of check out your vital statistics a little bit, Alan, before they took you on as daddy kind of thing. I've got an idea of you as a kid kind of having this paper delivered to you by the paper boy and your golden retriever bringing it to you or your father in his armchair. Was it a little bit like that? Is it a newspaper that you've grown up with?
Not at all. But I have a major obsession with newspapers, and I think it started at a very young age with the sports page, because growing up in LA, we were big Dodger and Laker fans, and so I'd start reading the sports page, and I'd see my dad reading a lot of papers, and so I just got more and more into it. And then in college, I started reading more newspapers. I built a very large business that I started in college, and the business it was a real estate business, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and we sold the whole company 3 days before Lehman Brothers failed. So it worked out extremely well. So I was 29, retired, not much going on. So I got married, I had a kid, started building a house, and I just started subscribing to more and more newspapers. And it got to the point where I started reading about 6 hours a day of newspapers, cover to cover, including the Financial Times of London, which is probably my favorite paper in the world. And so it was sort of like a great thing to have this extra time to feed the passion of newspapers, because prior to that, I could really only read a couple hours in the morning and maybe a couple hours at night. So I've never been on Facebook. I've never been on Twitter. I've never read a paper online. I'm a dinosaur, even though I'm 33. And I just love feeling the paper in my hand. I love going in the driveway and grabbing all the different papers and sorting them with my OCD and picking them up and reading them in the same exact order every day of my life. And so the Post has always been my favorite paper because it's very light and fun, right? They don't cover serious issues. They're not covering Syria or anything crazy going on in the world. It's hyper, hyper local about this wonderful, wonderful town where there's a whole lot of stuff going on all the time.
Well, let's dive into the pages of the Palisadian Post then, Alan, for a second. Unfortunately, I'm here in a studio in London. I'm talking to you on a telephone, so I've got to do this. I've got to look at some of your headlines online. But I'm looking at some of the breaking news stories here right now. Female pedestrian struck on PCH, seriously injured. Marquez Avenue, Sunset Boulevard, bus route update, etc., etc. These are, as you say, hyper-local things. And there's a lot of good news in here. There's a lot of pageants. There's a lot of, I guess they're not beauty contests anymore necessarily, but there's a lot of news about people, right?
That's right. So the Marquez story is a big story because the buses drive totally out of control in Los Angeles and they fly through stop signs, and a bus killed a teenager about 2 months ago. So the city and the county who run the bus lines decided to reroute the bus lines so that that dangerous turn wasn't there. Well, they rerouted it right in front of an elementary school with 500 kids coming in and out every day. So, you know, it's absolutely insane. Now, that would go unreported, right? The Los Angeles Times is not going to pick that up. The radio is not going to pick that up. But we throw it on our cover, and all of a sudden, you know, the city gets 300 letters and phone calls and starts holding hearings. And that's a story that just never would have been reported. Same thing with the other story you mentioned. It's just these are hyper, hyper local stories. And that's why the readership is so loyal. I'll tell you something incredible. Every Thursday morning, there's a line of people at our office waiting to get the paper. And so I really take this paper seriously. I really feel a moral obligation to my hometown and to those people and to these loyal readers to make sure the paper arrives every Thursday for as long as I live. Even if it's not financially feasible, I will continue to put the capital behind it because I'm in a very fortunate position to be able to do so.
Is there any temptation, Alan, to sort of tinker with the kind of age-old formula of the newspaper, of your newspaper, and kind of try to ramp up some of these stories to get a bit crusading and a bit campaigning so that people have got a kind of story to tune into each week? You know what I mean? Some of the British newspapers, national newspapers have done this, try to make people scared and people will kind of feel that they have to come to your newspaper. Or are you going to reflect the essentially happy living, dolce vita, kind of fairly crime-free life that Pacific Palisade dwellers live?
You know what? Maybe I misspoke about it. No, I mean, we do have those hard-hitting, scary stories. I mean, we have the Department of Water and Power wants to put in a giant power center in town, and nobody's reporting it. And it is a scary story because there's all sorts of studies that if you put it near homes or schools, that young children are susceptible to getting leukemia. And so that's been a really big story for us. It's been terrifying for everyone. It's been a cover story for 6 months. There's been protests, threats of litigation, public hearings. And that is a really scary one for people with young children who live in the areas where they're proposing it. The other one is there's a large developer named Rick Caruso who is in escrow to purchase a $50 million portfolio of almost all of the retail in this small town. And he is known for tearing down and building new projects. And there's a lot of residents around there. So that's been a really scary story for a lot of people and really juicy. So it's not all lovey-dovey puppy dogs and ice cream. It really does sort of have some of those more hard-hitting ones. We had a killer dog that lived north of Sunset Boulevard. He had bit one person, then he killed a dog, then he bit another person. Finally, the city stepped in and there were hearings and everybody was terrified the dog was going to kill a child. It was 150-pound, some sort of dog that really you shouldn't have in a family community or even in a city. And so that was a really scary story for all the residents in that neighborhood. They stopped walking their children. They stopped walking their dogs. And finally, the city removed the dog. And so that was a scary one. So we do have, you know, important, life-threatening, scary stuff. But we also do have sort of fun. Oh, look who's in college. Oh, look who just had a baby boy. You know, that kind of stuff.
That was Alan Smolinski, owner of the Palisadian Post. And if you want to see more of what that newspaper has to offer, just visit palisadespost.com. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We'll continue the media theme when we come back, but this time we'll be in Mali. Stay tuned.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where we're headed now to West Africa. Mali's been in a state of conflict since a military coup last March removed the president from power. Now French forces are bombing the north of the country, trying to push radical Islamists from their desert stronghold. But in the south, there's a battle of the hearts and minds going on via the state TV and radio channel. The building is under constant military protection for fear of another coup d'etat. To find out more about the station and how TV operates inside Mali, Rose Skelton visited and sent this report from Bamako.
In the centre of Mali's busy capital, Bamako, is a large concrete building which houses the state television and radio station, l'Office de Radio Diffusion et Télévision du Mali, known as ORTM. Youssef Touré is the director of television at ORTM. Shrouded by dust kicked up by the passing traffic and dressed in a sharp suit, he points to the group of armed soldiers sitting at either side of the gate and on the opposite side of the road.
We have the different security forces working here. We have the security guards. At the same time, there are the National Guard, a part of the army. There is the army itself. And they have been here since the 21st of March last year.
Youssef is talking about a coup d'etat, which, last March, a group of soldiers unhappy with the way the government was handling a rebellion in the north of the country, carried out. The coup sent Mali into a spiral of political chaos, and now the French military are trying to drive Islamic radical groups out of the northern part of the country. But the most serious fighting on that day happened here at ORTM, the nation's nerve centre. The guards remain because it's a place of huge strategic importance, as Youssef explains.
The situation is still unsure. We don't know who is running the country, so they are here to guard the radio station. It's a way for them to say, we have the power because we have the radio and television, which are the real vectors for getting information to the people.
Walking through the grounds of the station, a simple garden offering a bit of green in this dusty city, Youssef describes the day the soldiers came and took over the station.
I was in my office, and just before 4 o'clock, we heard gunshots, and my secretary said, the soldiers are coming, the soldiers are coming. We all went out and saw that the soldiers had taken over different parts of the building.
Climbing up the stairs to Youssef's small office on the second floor, he points out the bullet holes that smashed through the concrete walls and pierced the wooden door to his office.
You can see the walls, the damage, the fighting which made holes in everything, all over this building. They smashed up our offices and took everything we had. Here's a bullet hole. And you can see here, 4 holes in my office door. The ammunition went all the way through and destroyed everything on the other side.
There are only 2 official television channels in Mali, both owned and tightly controlled by the state. But now many people have access to foreign television stations, like the French international channel France 2. With the internet spreading through Mali, people can also get their news that way. But even so, there is still some loyalty amongst Malians for the traditional station, ORTM. And the government, desperately trying to get control of the country in the months following last year's coup, have been using it more and more to strengthen their positions. Makan Kone is the director of the Journalists' Union.
ORTM has always worked in the same way that people in power want it to. That is very clear. They don't say, do this, do that. They do things themselves, going right past the directors. During the transition, we had a prime minister, Sheikh Modibou Diarra. He came onto the television as if it was him who had bought our national television station. A guy who came from nowhere, who had absolutely no legitimacy, but the television became like his own. He recorded what he wanted. When he made a declaration, the television would show the whole thing. It was deplorable on the part of ORTM.
But though many people have access to foreign stations and the internet, Mali is still one of the world's poorest countries, where even getting electricity can be a challenge. Late at night, once the day has cooled down, people gather on benches outside neighborhood shops and catch up on the news. Dozens of people sometimes gather around a single television set in the otherwise dark street. Babi Abdurrahman is a young man who's come out to watch the news with his friends. He's watching ORTM, but says he doesn't really trust it. But it is the only channel they can get on this television.
There are some people who say that what they show on the television is not true. I watch it, I understand it, but it's not all that good. If I had a choice, I would watch channels like France 2.
Before the March coup, journalists in Mali say they had felt a tightening of their rights to speak openly in the press. Many journalists have been arrested or attacked for reporting on the current political instability. At ORTM, Yusuf says journalists aren't able to report the real news anymore. He has his own Sunday morning show, but feels he isn't really free to speak as he would like.
We don't tell lies on the television, but we don't tell the truth either. That's because of the political management of the television and radio. Those who are in power are the ones who give the line, what must happen, what must not happen. Now it's the president, the prime minister, the ministers, everything comes from them, and afterwards, we have to make it happen.
He believes that if the press had been free to film, record and report the real news and create a debate within Malian society, things could have turned out differently.
We would have been able to resolve the question of the North a long time ago because everyone could have had the same truth. Everyone would have known what was going on. If the politicians could have come and spoken on the TV and radio and the people had listened, a lot of problems would have been resolved. Open up the television and the radio and you fix around 80% of the problems.
With elections slated for July and the French-led bombing campaign still going strong in the north, it is hard for people in the south to get information that they can trust. People feel that every news outlet has a different agenda. Back in Yusuf's office, he explains why people still trust the national television and radio.
There is an adage that goes, Radio Mali has said. And if it's the Radio Mali which has said it, they trust this information more. Because from 1957 until 93, there was only Radio Mali, and it became the model in terms of information. If we say it's Radio Mali which has said it, that's the truth, the pure truth. If we say that RFI has said it, people say they are exaggerating. If they say that Radio Libre has said it, they say that this station belongs to someone. National radio is an identity. It belongs to everyone. So until the moment that Radio Mali has said it, people say it's not yet the truth.
While the future for Mali is uncertain, one thing is for sure. The military will stay guarding the ORTM building in Bamako until they're convinced that the country is in safe hands. For Monocle in Bamako, I'm Rose Skelton.
Thanks, Rose, and you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Still to come in part two, we'll meet William Adamson, the latest incarnation of musician Rob Gallagher, to hear how the folklore of Southeast England has inspired his new project. We'll hear what's coming up at this week's Art Dubai, and we'll hear some more from Suede's beautiful new record, Blood Sports. So before we head over to Dubai, first we're putting on our wellies and going to deepest Suffolk in East England. Rob Gallagher is a musician who's been experimenting in various genres since the 1980s. His previous incarnations have included Giles Peterson's acid jazz band Galliano and experimental poet-cum-songster Earl Zinger, among others. His latest project, under the guise of William Adamson, took inspiration from the folklore and wilds of Suffolk, where it was recorded. The album, Under an East Coast Moon, has a muggy but live quality, merging sea shanties with Louisiana blues, with tracks titled things like Foggy Dew, Creek Men, and Burial Blues. It's a road trip for the ears, and we were lucky enough to be treated to a little studio session of the material here at Midori House. Rob, or William, sat down with Culture's producer, Katie Bilboa, to explain more about the project.
So William Adamson was he was accused of blasphemy in 1665 in a place called Laxfield in Suffolk. Why I know an obscure fact like that is because we were basically about 3 years ago, we were given an art, when there was still money to give out arts grants. We got a grant to do, this is Two Banks of Four, me and my creative partner, Demas. We got some money to do a project about the East Coast. As the Two Banks of Four studio is up there, and we've mixed a lot of the Two Banks of Four albums, we did it around, so we basically gave ourselves 10, well, it's more than 10 miles, I suppose, kind of from Orford in Suffolk in the south up to Lowestoft into Laxfield. And Laxfield was one of these places.
And then, for those who don't know England so well, we should point out that this is an area in the East Anglia, we call it. So it's the eastern side of England, northeast of London, basically. The bit that sticks out, the bum of the UK, some people may refer to it.
Well, that's you who said that.
And I don't mean that it's not nice there, don't get me wrong.
The bum of England. the horn of the eastern horn. We're going into Carry On now, but anyway. So it was basically a project that came from some topography, you know. So set it there. And then once the ball's off and running, I guess in a way it can be a metaphor for any particular place. It's got its history and got its quirks, but... You know, there we found everything from an author called, Sebald, who did a walk through there about 5 or 6 years ago. And he did a book called The Rings of Saturn, which I never knew. And we'd done the session to make the album, and then suddenly picked up this paper that was an arts festival about the book. And then read the book, and you know, the book is tremendous. And that was one of the things we found while making the album. So it's interesting that we kind of tried to chain the creativity down into the landscape and the top, but then all these doors open up all over the place, and you know. So it ends up about being the kind of transitory nature of, you know, humans anyway, and everything's in and out and up and down and all around, and you know, so it's been quite a journey, which has also been reflected in the music, as in, you know, doing it live now, it's kind of gone very electronic and dub, and it started off in a barn with four musicians, you know, playing songs. Oh, well, they buried me, with no sign or stone to rely right over me. And no one knows I'm here, I'm like a fallen peer, lie right over me.
So tell me how some of that history and how some of that geography is fed into the album.
Well, I guess it was a deliberate process of mapping out that physical area and then literally researching places, you know, I'd never really written like that before. Then you're doing everything through the Peasants' Revolt to, you know, and then lepers there. But then you come up the oddments, like there was you know, because you love your murder ballads and your curiosities and all the rest. And Tom Waits actually wrote a tune about this Red Barn murder, which is a woman who... Now, did he kill her or he kill her? And he's forgotten. I think she killed him.
It's a memorable one.
Quite an important point, who killed who. But anyway, it was a famous murder, buried her under the barn, dug her up. And then in the end, this guy gets caught. He gets either hanged or, must have been hanged then. And then he becomes a curiosity. And I think this is 1800s, and his body is saved for science, and they make, you know, dried him out. And so, you know, there's all this stuff going on. And he actually wrote a song about that, the Red Barn Murders. So, you know, so there's little kind of microscopic kind of things going on that then has a resonance all over the place, you know, which I guess in a way you could do anywhere. But, you know, we were in that and started finding all these things. So, yeah. And then voices keep calling, voices now they ain't stalling. One more year to London's on fire, I hear them what they say and what they can call.
And so you found all these amazing stories from the past in this area of Britain. Going back to what you were saying about how you've, you know, what musical influences have gone into this album, how did you combine some of those influences with those stories? How did that kind of come together, that process, and how did that develop?
That's an interesting one, almost the musical story as well, because the musical story of America, you know, you could say is from Africa and from Europe. And there was plenty of people from around that area, you know, who went out with their songs and their instruments, who ended up in America, and, you know, music's fuse and all the rest of it. And, you know, the popular music that we now are listening to, there's an influence from over here that fed into that, that then feeds a couple of hundred years back into us growing up with, you know, essentially, you know, I suppose, American culture, as we all did. But then we fuse it with, you know, all the rest of the stuff we grew up with. And, you know, so from Jamaica, the bass lines to the kind of what's indigenous here and kind of what's going on here. And then come at it again from our point of view. So in a way it was, you know, I suppose we wanted to get a kind of swampy feel and, you know, experimental stuff from, the usual crew, from the Beefarts and the Zappas and et cetera, et cetera. But also, I guess it's all what's inside you anyway, and you come at it. But I'd never started thinking of it like that. But I guess it is as well, you know, these massive circles of history turn where, you know, we're just normal men growing up with those influences. But that's because other people a few hundred years ago went out there, and that's the way it happened, you know, so...
It's all a big circle. Big,
yeah. So basically my point is, it's all a big circle.
So you made the album, and then you've made a dub album, or disco mix, as I see it's called, on vinyl.
Extended disco mix.
And you said now you're starting to perform it live. How does it work when you do it live? Because the session you've done for us here, there's been a bit of a backing track. Is that how it's going to be when it's performed live, or how is it evolving as you perform?
Well, it's evolved quite a bit already. I mean, you know, obviously there's financial constraints as well, but also wanted to kind of do it because we're ending up in a lot of clubs due to it's coming out on Giles Peterson's label, and obviously he plays a lot of clubs, so, you know, it's got to kind of work in that environment. Yeah, so the first one I did was just with this guitar. So, you know, that's more acoustic and it can go that way. But at the moment, we've only done one gig in Paris on Sunday. But I'm doing it with a guy called Hugh, who works with Matthew Herban, people who can basically, I can feed my stuff into him, and he can loop, use loops and turn me back in on myself, and we can make a beat out of stuff and then do it through that way. So we've almost taken the, because we made an album and then the dub album, so we've used the dub as almost a way into the live, and then put beats underneath that. So yeah, so basically we're just trying to go Hudson Mohawk and trap music. William Adamson is a liar.
That was Rob Gallagher, aka William Adamson, and his new album, Under an East Coast Moon, is out now on Brownswood Recordings. As you heard there, you can also pick up a disco mix of the album on vinyl. And if you're keen to see it live, you can catch William at Giles Peterson's Worldwide Festival on the 23rd of March in Lausanne in Switzerland. You're tuned in right now to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Art Dubai next.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where via a slightly crackly phone line we head to Dubai to speak with Antonia Carver, director of the Middle East's premier art event and leading art fair Art Dubai. In its seventh year and after some ups and downs in the financial affairs of the Emirate, how do you keep a fair fresh, keep the visitors and importantly the buyers rocking up, and how do you attempt to influence the curatorial instincts of the region? Antonia Carver tells us how.
Art Dubai began in 2007 with 40 galleries. We now have 75. And in that period, which has actually been going on for, I guess, the past decade of growth in Dubai, it's also the city has completely changed. Around that time, there were a handful of galleries. There are now over 40. And Dubai is recognized as the regional market center. And we've also seen over the last couple of years, those kind of commercial galleries and this huge commercial gallery sector be supplemented by not-for-profit institutions and kind of experimental art spaces and educational institutions. So the whole sort of scene is maturing. And at Art Dubai itself, we've introduced a number of new initiatives. The not-for-profit program that goes alongside the gallery halls has grown immensely over the last couple of years. And I think we now have a bigger projects and commissioning program than any other fair worldwide. So this year, there are over 40 artists that are involved in our commissions program and including around 14 new commissions. So Ehsan Ulhuq, for example, who's an artist from Lahore in Pakistan, has produced a herd of plaster donkeys, and it's all about sort of following the herd, and I'm sure there are many analogies there with not only the art world, but also the worlds of fashion and also politics. So he's kind of a very interesting project. And Ahmet Ogut, who's a Turkish artist who has a show at, just finished a show at Tate Modern at the moment and becoming something of a kind of international star, is setting up a VIP lounge, but specifically for interns. So the only people that can get access to this very exclusive lounge, which has a chocolate fountain and mocktail hours and all sorts of things going on, are the unpaid kind of labor of the fair. So these are just a couple of examples of how this sort of non-commercial program is growing and growing.
And I wanted to ask you about the project specifically, Antonia. Obviously, an art fair is mostly, not wholly, but mostly a commercial enterprise. But the project's very important, getting the curatorial kind of roots in the ground, especially in a place like Dubai, which is obviously a commercial centre. How far ahead do you plan the projects? I know, I guess, from year to year, you're constantly working on the fair. But how quickly can you swoop on a great idea and get an artist in and get something commissioned?
Well, we kind of really pride ourselves, I guess, on being quite a flexible model. I mean, we have 75 galleries, whereas some of the conglomerate fairs are looking at sort of 200 plus. So I think we're really particularly responsive to new trends. So I guess mainly through the section that we call Marker, which is a section of invited galleries, which then sparks further involvement through talks and commission programs. And this year we're looking at West Africa. And we knew from a couple of years ago that we wanted to look at one aspect of the African art scenes or the many African art scenes. And after some research visits to Senegal and Nigeria, we realized that what was happening in West Africa was very special. And also, of course, the various cities of Africa have very strong relationships with Dubai. So we wanted to take that kind of idea and build on it in terms of contemporary art. So we have great art spaces coming from Senegal, Ghana, Cameroon, Mali, and Nigeria, and around 25 artists showcasing their work in the fair. And this will be the largest showcase of West African art, not only in the Middle East, but in any kind of international fair of our standing.
And can you tell me about the kind of the economic side of that, how you get these artists installed in Dubai, how that works? Obviously, as we say, an art fair is a commercial enterprise with these curatorial things attached. It's clearly all about art. But how does that work, getting everybody over there and getting them set up, installed and displaying their works?
Well, we're kind of midway through this at the moment. There's a sort of frenzy of activity, you know, and this is really a time when Dubai acts as a hub for the art world. I mean, increasingly internationally, we see that Dubai is seen as a gateway to Asia alongside Hong Kong. So we see we have around 75 museum groups flying in for the fair from all over the world, but predominantly Europe and America. And I think really the way the art world is kind of mirroring this economic shift towards the East. And, you know, in the art world today, if you're a gallerist in Paris or New York or London, it's not enough to sit in your home city and feed the local market. You've really got to be engaged in Asia in order to sort of be part of this kind of future story. And I think that's something that Dubai is very much poised to do and is already kind of functioning as one of these Asian or new emerging kind of arts capitals and acting very much as a hub.
I wanted to ask you finally, Antonio, about film stuff. There's a little bit of an emphasis on video art and films this year as well, isn't there?
Well, that's something that the fair has been kind of paying a lot of attention to since the very beginning. And this year we've made use of the biggest kind of stairwell in the centre of the fair and set up something that we modestly call The Hatch, which has a great film and video programme focusing on artists like Hassan Khan, an Egyptian artist who's particularly well known on the international stage, Ali Cherry, who's a young Lebanese artist, and then Anri Saleh, who of course is very well known. And that programme was put together by Maha Mahmoun, who's a curator from Cairo. So really, this is right at the heart of the fair, and film and video plays a very large role. So we really tried to take the kernel of what happens within the world of contemporary art and then take it out into poetry, music, literature, filmmaking, and really take a big sort of 360-degree view of our particular subject.
And just finally, on galleries, I know that when Art Dubai started out, a couple of the big boys, White Cube especially, was out there. Now I see that they're missing from the roster, and it almost makes for more interesting reading. Galleries like Pace are there, and Pace are now in three cities. Does this kind of allow you to sort of refresh the roster of galleries when there aren't these large sort of gallery sharks circling your pool? I mean, it's the most international mix of galleries for any of the major art fairs, isn't it?
Absolutely. We really see ourselves as a fair of discovery. So we've really sort of thought, how do we put together a fair where the work stays fresh, where you have a chance to really discuss it? And also, if you're really kind of going for being a fair of discovery, and even if you're the most jaded of museum directors or collectors, and you arrive at Art Dubai, what we're really aiming for is them to get to grips with new ideas, new regions, new artists. This takes, you know, a bit of thought and a bit of research and conversations. And so we want to make the space and time for people to be able to do that. And then alongside it, really promote discussion through the Global Art Forum, artist projects, and really kind of turning the fair inside out.
That was Antonia Carver, Director of Art Dubai, which starts this week. For more information, visit artdubai.ae or jump on one of those Emirates planes. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be assessing South by Southwest once the dust has settled and hearing from the director of a documentary about Radio France. We're also going to crowbar some Bowie in, both exhibition and album. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. The show was produced by the combined geniuses Katie Bilbao and Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from that great new record by Suede, Bloodsports. This is Sometimes I Feel I'll Float Away. Thanks for tuning in. Sometimes I